listeners of the Call Sheet podcast and live radio show, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial a month to give you the opportunity to check out their service. I personally recommend and can give you, listeners of our show, an audiobook of your choice at audible.com. We are giving away the hottest, sexiest book, 50 Shades of Grey, Book 1, Unabridged by E.L. James. This is sexy, this is hot, and you can get it by going to audibletrial.com/Skid Row Studios. Us here, our studio, our wonderful, brilliant studio with well over a dozen and a half shows, including the Call Sheet. Go to audibletrial.com/Skid Row Studios for your free audiobook. Coogan, thank you for listening. Welcome to the Call Sheet, Tales of the Bone Machine. We're coming to you live or time-shifted if you're listening to this tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. when we repeat the show. Every single day at 9 a.m. you can hear the previous week's and other great archived episodes. Thank you, jfrocks.com and Jeff Fiorentino for our great theme music. I'm joined here by beyondthemarquee.com's John Donahue. Thanks for coming back, John. What are you pouring a really tall one right there? Is that booze?
Allers, it tastes like Arnold Palmer's armpit.
Ooh.
It's pretty bad.
Does it give you some sort of energy? Zero, no calorie? What's the point of drinking? It's iced tea lemonade, I see.
Zero calories, all shit.
That's very nice. Do you play golf at all?
No. This is the closest I get to golf, is drinking Arnold Palmer.
This won't improve your game at all. And no. We have a special guest tonight. We have a gentleman who's been in the business for 26 years, probably longer than that. A lot of times before people officially come into the business, there's a lot of work that goes into it. So we're joined here tonight by Rodney Eastman, best known for Nightmare on Elm Street 3, and I think they finally finish you off in 4. Right?
They do indeed. Hello.
You managed to live only like, did Patricia Arquette live through the first one?
She did, but she wasn't in part 4. They couldn't afford her.
No, they're like, Heather Langenkamp is cheap, we're keeping her.
No, they killed off Heather in part 3.
Oh,
it was a shame.
Man. Well, what an honor. What a great horror film. What a great film. Totally pop culture. I think Freddy, people have to mention Michael Myers, Jason Voorhees, and Freddy Krueger as the top villains of really our whole generation.
Leatherface.
I think Freddy tops them all completely objectively, not because I'm connected to the films.
Oh, no, not that you know, paid by New Line.
I don't get a kickback at all.
When they get the box set out with like all 19 of them, it's like you don't get...
Yeah, but the residual for the box set was pretty impressive, I got to tell you.
Nice.
It's not even on Blu-ray in the States yet, so you still, I mean...
Oh, is that true?
You know more about it
than I do.
I do. There's not a box set. You can get 1 and 2 and 3 come boxed together. You can't get 4, the Rennie Harlan version.
Right.
Oh. You can't get that. You can't get 5.
That's a burn.
But you can get Freddy versus Jason.
Man, that is such a burn.
It is a burn.
New Line Family was fun to be in the 80s, early 90s.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, that was a good hoot. Working for New Line, you like that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they were a really bargain basement little studio. But they were putting out great films.
Ninja Turtles.
They promote... Because I know they didn't have the kind of studio cash. They were a distributor originally that went into self-production, financed their own things.
Right.
Truly an independent studio, and that's really rare even today.
Absolutely. Bob Shea started the company, and he was selling films out of his trunk, driving around the southeast of the United States. And, the Nightmare films really you know, just really word of mouth.
In the industry, and Bob, too, or in the columns and stuff, they always called New Line Cinema the house that Freddie built.
Yeah, absolutely.
Dolls, games, alarm clocks, slippers, I mean, you name it. Of course, Halloween costumes.
Yeah, the merchandising really, kept them afloat. I think they've been sold to Warner Brothers now.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think by the time they got to part three, they had established a pretty good base, a pretty huge fan base, and it's really interesting. I only realized how massive those films were in retrospect. You know, when I was 19, 20, 21, I was blissfully unaware. You know, I wasn't really, and it wasn't, you know, there was no computers.
You were that young. It was 86. Oh, okay.
So yeah, I was 19 years old when I did Nightmare on Elm Street 3.
You looked like a baby.
Yeah.
Still. Little baby Joey.
I'd really like to start looking my age eventually. It's
Any special challenges to being mute? Were you deaf and mute or just deaf? Or
no,
how did
just,
that work?
Just mute.
Just mute. Okay.
Yeah.
Never
really explained either.
Also,
it's really funny. In the opening scene, you see me, I have like a teardrop tattoo on my face.
I saw that.
And then it's never to be seen again throughout the entire film.
I didn't even realize
that. Pretty hilarious. Yeah.
And in the script, it was like, there's Joey, he's crying. And the makeup was like, we just put this tear on. I don't know.
Yeah, they just put the tear on. I wasn't at the acting level. I didn't have the chops yet to cry on cue, so they just drew it on.
It was broke out fucking glycerin on my ass when I couldn't, you know.
Or how about the menthol blowers?
Sure, sure. Hey, let's blow some glass right in your eye.
Yeah.
That works for me.
You, one of the first thing I see is, it says, CBS School Break Special, after school specials were always part of, your repertoire as a kid. Oh my God, and the sitcoms and stuff as you started to get in there. Tell us how you first got into the business and how you first started and how you first actually got on into showbiz.
Well, it's really interesting that, you know, you said earlier that, having been in the business for 26 years, but you're sure that I had probably done, you know, a lot of footwork before that. That really wasn't the case with me. When kids today ask me how to get into the business, I tell them, well, first of all, I tell them if they're not willing to starve and sacrifice everything in their life to do this, to just turn around right now and get a real career, because the competition is hellacious nowadays. It was rough 25 years ago, but now, especially with the advent of all this reality television, there's 50% of the projects even available for actors.
Well, it was rough, but fair.
Yeah,
it was
completely.
Very insular, closed off system. There was definitely a lot of competition, but when it came right down to your type and your part and your age, you're like, I could name the two other guys that I'm going to see at this audition, period.
Absolutely.
Every time.
But how I got into the business, I always wanted to be an actor, and I grew up in Los Angeles. I grew up in East LA, 12 miles from Hollywood, but it was, another world away. I never, I didn't have any family in the business. I didn't have any connections to the business. my mom had a friend who was a publicist manager, through this weird circumstances, friend of a friend, friend of my mom's, he knew that I wanted to be an actor, and he asked me if I wanted to do some extra work. And I said, yeah, for sure. And so I went down, and his friend was first AD on the film. So every scene that there were extras, he would put me up in the front of the crowd. And what ended up happening is I met an actress on the set, not an extra, but one of the real actresses. And we started hanging out. And, I don't know if people know it, but when you're an extra on films, they keep you far away from the action. You know, if you're on location, wherever the location is, they keep the extras three blocks away in a tent.
In a dark, cold dungeon.
It's really
watered down Kool-Aid.
Really, yeah, really
stale
sad.
Ritz crackers. You know,
stale pretzels.
Hey and, there.
Yeah. But because I was hanging out with this actress, I got to hang out with her and stay close to the action. And I watched the actors, and I thought, you know, as any great egotistical 18-year-old, I thought, I can do that better.
You know? Now, was she just hot for you? And she's like, come on, spend some time. She's got to sit there all day in the same place shooting this scene, right? She's like, wants to spend time with little Rodney.
Yeah, she was an older woman, and she nice. Took advantage of me. My first Hollywood love affair is pretty incredible. But after that, I told this friend of the family's. I said, I want to pursue this. And he said, all right, well, I'm going to get you into a class. And I went to Joanne Hardin's Young Actor Space out in the Valley. You know, it just came really natural to me. And, you know, he told me, when you feel like you're ready, give me a call and I'll try and set you up with an agent. So... after about a month, I called and told him I was ready, and he said, well, you know, don't you think you should take a little more time? I said, no, let's do it. So he got me an interview with a little agency called Kelman Arletta, and I walked in. I read a couple of pages for them. And
Tony Kelman.
Tony Kelman.
And I don't even remember Arletta.
But, you know.
Wow.
You know, the business back then... A little tiny agency like that could exist.
If people
no
can
problems.
Imagine how they take beef that they raise on like rainforest land in Brazil, they pack these beef and then they bring them through a slaughterhouse and they grind them through loud, noisy, and efficiently. That's a kid's agency.
Right.
That's horrible. Yeah.
It is. There's like 20 desks.
Right.
There's like two main big agents, but there's tons of like the people that do all the legwork, and they're just sitting there submitting. And John is naturally tall and good looking. Huh. And he just winds up on the greatest.
Only for the radio.
And through, through both talent and just great connections and the ability to walk up and seem very charming. And you charmed me. I don't really know you. I don't know. Thanks. Who are you, John?
That and 20 bucks. So you got friends.
And you're a great host. I'm Beyond the Marquee.
Thank you.
Tough to be an on-air camera host.
Well, are you guys going to kiss?
That's tough.
No, the
radio is easy. You can come in wearing your
workout
clothes.
Yeah, I love it.
Clothes.
I didn't have to get ready or anything. Pretty great.
You're wearing your Freddy slippers in Rome. That's
right.
I have to admit, you've changed your appearance several times throughout. You had a kid look, an adolescent, you know, and also we were talking before the show. You wish people would see you, or not? None of the wish people that they don't see you as your age.
No, you're not.
I don't know if you talk about it.
I used to hide it, but I really don't care anymore. And you really can't hide anything now with the internet, you know. And IMDb especially, it's terrible.
Actress
once you give them your actual birth date on IMDb, you can never take it off. They will not allow it. They won't.
There was an effort taken by you to take off.
I tried to get rid
of some credit, and they were like, why do you want to take this off? And I was like, I guess I want, and they left it on.
Crafty.
I was trying to get Kurt rid of Crafty. This is the episode you directed, John.
Once it's up there, it's up there.
You did a Warnowski movie. Was this also the, Chopping Mall. It says you're a shoplifter.
Oh, I love
true?
Chopping
extra.
Mall.
I was an extra.
Okay, so this is the first AD placement.
No, the project where I met the girl and figured out I could be an actor, that was called Have You Tried Talking to Patty? It was my other favorite movie. After school special.
There it is.
About a deaf girl at public high school.
And you trying to tuck in your panties?
Oh, you're brutal.
So wait a minute. You were an extra. So you couldn't talk.
Not PC.
It was about a girl who was deaf, and then you went on to a Freddy movie where you didn't talk.
That's right. It's a theme in my life.
I love it.
And also, funnily enough,
thinking
Mark.
Thinking there, John. Thanks.
Mark.
Palmer.
I don't know his last name, but the lead from Nightmare on Elm Street 2,
mm-hmm.
Mark. We can Google it. He was the lead in Have You Tried Talking to Patty?
Any connection with any managers or publicists or agents or anything?
No,
where
no,
you
no.
Go,
purely,
I know this clan.
Purely coincidental.
Showing up at the same sets with the same people.
No, no, purely.
Did you, because, and it's not even this, and I really can't go through piece by piece because I have to honestly say, you have more motherfucking credits than I do.
Yeah, a lot of credits.
And so there's no way to go through them. I just want to pick out, and we're talking, you know, some recent great shows like Bones, Breakout Kings.
Wait, can I finish my little story?
Oh, I thought you were done.
Monk, all of these, The Mentalist. The point is, okay. Well, no, keep going. Finish your story. Please.
Okay,
it's getting there.
I'll shorten it up.
It anyway.
Kalmanar let us sign me. A week later, they sent me out on my first audition, and I got the part and got Taft Hartley and got into the Screen Actors Guild. My first audition.
Wow.
So it really sort of, you know, the decision to become an actor and my first job on a SAG project was about 4 months. So I was really lucky. It really fell into my lap, which kind of worked against me. You know, I'm making a confession. I've never really had to work that hard to get work, especially when I was younger. And it's kind of come back to bite me in the ass because
Jimmy Stewart, Cary Grant, they all felt that this wasn't really work either. And they fell into it, too. And we're very grateful to do it. I think the key is, this is the point about all the shows after shows after shows, and like whether it's a connection for the first AD or producers or director, how is you seem to have been kept building bridges your whole time, and everyone kept you just
and burning them,
you know, and burning.
Yeah,
give me an opportunity, I'll piss all over it.
Yeah,
no, but you kept. It's so great. All of the who's the boss? You always got to wind up on who's the boss, right?
Absolutely.
Is it 80s? Yeah. Good actor.
Did you do that, Keith?
Yeah.
No, I did not. Who's the
I'm just
pissed.
Yeah, and I had a scene with Alyssa Milano. It was so great.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. I got to like razz Alyssa Milano about her horrible car in high school. So great.
The order sometimes on IMDb is all funny.
Uh-huh.
Highway to Heaven, was that before or after The Nightmare on Elm Street?
That was book, after. TV, I mean, Nightmare on Elm Street 3 was my third job ever. As an actor.
Wow.
Yeah.
And from there, it was just, were you on fire?
Pretty consistent, yeah. But, you know, I was, like I say, it came really easy to me. I didn't realize what I had when I had it. I didn't realize, that the Nightmare movies were, I was a huge fan of slasher films and great 80s horror. And I knew they were successful. But I just wasn't really... I didn't understand how the business worked. It was my third job. I didn't understand that you work hard to get a film at a certain level, and then from that level, you springboard to the next level, and so on and so on.
You're just doing this kind of job, then this kind of job.
And right, and, you know, doing Nightmare on Elm Street 3.
Lawrence Fishburne tucked him into bed.
Yeah.
In Nightmare on Elm Street.
So great.
Did you know he was in Apocalypse Now or anything like that?
I did. Ooh. I was... staggered that he was in this movie. And that's the thing. In 1987, Nightmare on Elm Street was not iconic. It was popular, but it was not what it has become now.
It was part two. I mean, I don't remember what the reaction was at the time.
Horrible.
I know it was a horrible film.
Right.
But part three, I remember everybody was jazzed about it. We all went to see it, my friends. Yep. We loved the skeletons. Yep. You know, Freddy's skeleton walking around with a shovel. I mean, all that stop motion stuff. I mean, the movie was just awesome with the great. Well, who did the soundtrack to that? They were
Dawkins.
Angelo Badalamenti.
Yes. Yeah. So they had a screening, a 25th anniversary screening on Monday, and at the Chinese Theater, and it was sold out. It was really incredible. But Badalamenti. Is that how you?
Badalamenti.
Whatever.
Yeah.
You know.
He did Cousins. He did the soundtrack to the Isabella Rossellini and the music for her commercials, the perfume commercials and stuff.
It was all of a sudden. It was like I was like, God, this is like a spaghetti western horror film. It's pretty great. But yeah, it wasn't an iconic film back then, and I just saw it as doing a low budget horror film. You know, that's really what it was. And then, you know, the phenomenal success, you know, came after the fact. And, you know, I was just an actor, you know, beating the pavement, trying to get my next job. And then Part Four was the highest grossing independent film to ever come out. At that point, mm-hmm. It got knocked
only
off.
Only beat by Ninja Turtles.
It got actually got knocked off by... Sex, Lies, and Videotape.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I didn't even see that.
Both films were top grossers in the years that they came out. Top 10 grossers. Pretty incredible. For little movies made for, you know, I think, you know, Nightmare on Elm Street 3 was probably at a $3 million budget, $4 million budget. Pretty crazy.
That is crazy and so creative, so inventive. And not only the merchandising and you know, going to see the film, but it wound into your psyche.
Yeah.
You would be up at night and not want to sleep or afraid if there was bad dreams.
Yeah, absolutely.
That they could hurt you.
Part Three is really well written. You know, they really
it's a
hit.
A cult of kids that aren't understood by adults and don't give a fuck. I love how the parents are so disconnected from the kids.
Right.
They really don't give a fuck.
Yeah, especially the mothers. So great.
They're the ones that did it. I mean, that's right. The great thing is the kids paying for this mistake parents' generation had made.
Yeah, I mean, it's really, you know, there's so many little analogies in the film, you know, commenting on culture at the time. You know, every character in that movie is such an archetype, you know, and Wes Craven came back for that film and co-wrote it. And, you know, he's a strange duck, but a brilliant creative mind, you know, and he really, if you watch the film, you know, I loved watching it. I hadn't seen it on a big screen in so long, and it was so great.
It's fun. Didn't it play almost like it had the Scream self-aware mentality already built in?
Absolutely.
It felt like it was already riffing on, and it was the great thing about Nightmare on Elm Street as a series, is within each dream, within each issue, each personal, psychological, there could be addiction, whatever, there was an attempt to go for a genre, and they could play on other films, music videos. We have a caller from the 801. Thank you for calling the call sheet. You're on the air. How can we help you? Can we take your
hello?
Order? Hello? All right, we
was it something
you
said?
801? Hello?
Where's 801?
And you're gone. All right, we had a caller.
Where's that?
Wow, I was so excited. This is my first radio show.
I can call.
You totally breaking your cherry.
Yeah, you are.
We haven't
be
quite
gentle
cursed
with me
that much yet, but we can say what we like. 801. We're talking, the North American Numbering Plan in Wasatch Front, Northern Utah. Thank you, Utah, for calling in. But
all of Utah.
Is that 801?
Yeah.
Yeah. Utah is an interesting state. I've spent some time in Utah.
You have.
I have.
Some friends in Utah that want to contact you. This is nice.
Really? Maybe
this
I know
is good.
Them.
This is some old pals.
Utah is a very interesting state. So controlled by the church, the Mormon church, and... to be a freak in Utah, you really have to go for it. You know, there's no sort of gray area.
No half-mast with the freak flag?
No, absolutely okay. Not. You know, you're either on the right or on the left. There's no moderates in Utah.
So I have a question.
Please.
What was your favorite experience, Elm Street 3 or 4? I mean, I'm sure they were both great. Do you have a preference?
Nightmare on Elm Street 3, for sure.
Just because it was your big breakout?
Yeah, I had done... The first job I did was a movie called Children of Times Square with Lou Gossett Jr. And My friend Danny Nucci was in it.
Yay!
Yeah. And then it was about 8 months of auditioning and not booking anything. And I was really, before I became an actor, I was going to be an architect. I really focused on that in high school and got accepted to a great school. And I, you know, I figured I'd take a year and try the acting thing and see what happened. And after about, it was 8 months, and I thought, you know, I gave it a go, and I got to do something, and, you know, I got to do something that probably, that very few people ever get to actually do. And, but I was ready to hang it up, and then I got an audition for a TV show called The Judge, which was a you know, pre-People's Court. It was a fake, you know, a fake courtroom drama shot on video. And I auditioned for it and got the part, and that was really exciting. And about a week after I did that job, I got the audition for Nightmare on Elm Street 3. So it really was my third real job. It was pretty incredible. So I had such a good time doing it. It was really my introduction to filmmaking. And working with Ira Hyden, Patricia Arquette, Bradley Gregg, Ken Sagos, Jennifer Rubin. It really was, it was a 6-week shoot, and it really felt like a great little family, you know? It wasn't like I was the one kid on the set with no connection to anybody. It was like camp, you know? So yeah, I had a great time. There's a great documentary called Never Sleep Again.
Oh, that's a good one.
The Elm Street Legacy. And it's like a 3-hour long documentary. And they go through every episode of the Nightmare franchise in great detail. And, you know, it's been sort of touted as, you know, the greatest horror documentary ever made. And it's really good and really interesting and really compelling. You can, ElmStreetLegacy.com, you can get some more information about it. But I don't know why I brought that up, but it just really, you know, it just sums up, you know, what the experience was like in a real authentic way. You know, I had a great time doing that. And then part four felt, you know, very... Well, first of all, Patricia Arquette didn't come back. And I really think that it was a financial issue. And I don't think she was asking for a ton of money. And and they didn't want to pay it. And so they're
saving up for Jim Carrey in a few years. Caller from the 213. Yo, what's up? Thanks for calling the call sheet. How you doing?
I'm doing good. Is Rodney Eastman actually there?
Ira Hyden.
How do you pull me out of the bag just like that? Come on. I mean, like, I thought I could fool you for a second.
This is Ira Hyden, the wizard master.
Hi, Ira. It's Keith. This is John Donahue.
Hey, Ira.
Ira's
hey there.
Good old friend. Good to talk to you again, Ira.
Good to hear
your voice.
Good to talk to you. Are you back in Los Angeles yet?
No, I'm actually still in Clay Alum, Seattle right now. At a family reunion, but I knew that you were going to be on the radio tonight on Skid Row, and I had to call in and say that, one, I am a huge, huge Rodney Eastman fan. And second of all, please stop kicking my butt in Words with Friends, because I'm kind of getting tired of it.
Yeah, well, you know, if you want to play, you got to pay, you know.
I'm not just
another pretty face, Ira, you know.
I like that. Okay.
But, you know, keep at it. You're getting better, you know.
Thank you.
I'll try and go easy on you.
I know, and I appreciate that, Rodney. Listen, I just wanted to give a quick shout out and say that Rodney is one of my favorite Dream Warriors and one of my really good friends. And I'm proud to have had this friendship for so long.
Yeah, likewise. It's... you know, I think that I was just talking about the film feeling like a little family and really sort of feeling like camp. And I think the fact that we're still friends is sort of a testament to that. I mean, every project you do, you always tell your fellow actors, oh, let's stay in touch and let's get together. And honestly, that quite seldom happens. But Ira and I have remained friends for many, many years. Hey, Ira, are you going to Orlando in October?
I would love to. Let's try and make that happen.
You want Horror Nights? Universal? Because I'm going to go.
Spooky Empire. Spooky Empire is a convention in Orlando, Florida, October 26th through the 28th. And they're having a giant Nightmare on Elm Street 3 and 4 reunion. Rennie Harlan's going to be there. Robert Englund. Bradley Gregg, and like everybody that was involved in the film, it's going to be a really good time.
We need to make that happen. Definitely, that would be a lot of fun. And yes, you know, who knew when we made this film, Nightmare on Elm Street 3? Who knew what we were actually doing? I mean, we were just young, struggling actors that were very happy to be working for Scale Plus 10, and it blossomed into just the greatest thing. And you know, our friendships that have held through, and you know, Ken Sagos, of course, and Jennifer and Bradley, and
we missed you at the screening on Monday.
I know. Well, you knew that I was leaving for Seattle.
So. I did.
It's a wonderful, wonderful thing, and I would love to do October. That would be a lot of fun.
All right. Well, let's talk about it later.
Hey, let's do that. And it's your play,
Ira. I have a question for you. Well, actually, I don't have a question.
And if you want more information on that, it's spookyempire1word.com. Spookyempire.com. Check it out.
And I just want to say, love your character in Elm Street 3, the wizard. And
I appreciate it.
And Elvira, Mistress of the Dark. Love that movie. And it's one of my favorites.
Thank you for pulling that out instead of Zapped Again. All right, guys, I got to go.
Thank you for doing it so I didn't have to. Appreciate right. that.
All right, Rodney, I'll see you back in L.A.
Take care, buddy.
Okay, bye, guys.
Good night.
Oh, that's sweet. I'm going to shed
time
a little
I saw
tear.
Ira, he was taking money from me at a poker game. good. Those were fun times. God, you guys, that's so great that you guys remained close all these years.
Yeah.
You recognize the voice like right away.
Absolutely.
Crazy. He still has that same voice you remember from the movie.
And he still looks exactly the same.
I'm pissed about that.
What's
Brad
that?
Blow, Peter Bogdanovich picture.
Illegally yours?
Yeah. Ira got that. I was so fucking pissed. Ira, if you're still listening, I'll get you. Back to me.
It's kind of Freddy right there.
Freddy was great. He scared the fuck. I was probably 16, I think, when it came out. It came out in like 86, 88 was the, what year was 3? 80?
I think it came out in 87, 88.
Yeah. It is the 25th, so it's 87.
I was working at a movie theater, single screen theater, I was telling you earlier, right. In upstate New York.
February.
And when I was a teenager. I think it was 89, Elm Street 4 came out.
Right.
And we had this little tiny old projectionist, picture Mr. Magoo, he's like 80 years old. he always used to mark up the films because it was reel-to-reel changeover.
Right.
He used to mark them up like with razors, so you'd be watching the movie, all of a sudden you'd be blinded by this big white X, so he'd know when to change the reel over. Well, every night we realized we were getting out 5 minutes early every night, and people were coming out into the lobby going, geez, whatever happened to Kincaid? He just didn't die. He just didn't come up. He didn't come back.
Right.
And he was changing the reel over before Freddie had a chance to kill him
nice.
To the next scene. So it was Kincaid, right? He just never died.
Right.
At this theater.
So. Jennifer Rubin had a nice little, literally a mini horror career with Nightmare on Elm Street 3 and Bad Dreams.
Right.
And what a sweetheart from Bad Dreams. I mean, I had such a crush on this poor girl.
She's great.
Yeah.
I played in my theater too.
Confession, I've never seen it.
Are you serious?
No.
Oh. It's fun. It's a great 80s movie, man.
I got to put it on my Netflix list.
She's phenomenal in it.
She really is.
Survivor of this cult that all immolated themselves, set themselves on fire.
Right.
She's the only survivor. And the cult leader years later calls to her in her dreams. And it's not Freddy like at all. It's way more like... Lord of Illusions or Mouth of Madness or something. It's a little, and Jennifer's just very.
She really does make the movie. Really does make the movie.
Lawrence motherfucking Fishburne.
Yeah, pretty that unbelievable.
Yeah, and he was, he rocked it too.
We're waiting for him to call tonight.
I double-taked it. I went, is that really Larry Fishburne? So cool, and so cool that you knew at the time too. And Robert Englund. Now, at this point, Robert, I got to do this snake movie with Robert. And he was so fun and had fun doing it.
He's an amazing guy.
By the third movie, was he done with the makeup? Had they figured it out and made it easy on him? Was he great? Was he tough or what, you know? Did you see Freddie run around? I mean, he tortured you a couple times.
Part three was, he was spending, it was taking 6 hours every day to do his makeup. Unbelievable. He was a character. I mean, again, I was 19 years old, sort of really wet behind the ears, and we didn't have much connection. You know, I really didn't have anything to talk about with older types. But again,
had you seen V? Had you seen him?
I had.
Weasley
I had
in
absolutely.
You're like,
yeah,
yay,
I knew who he was.
How cool
and, you know,
V.
I mean, I was a huge, you know, like I said before, I was a huge horror fan. So I had seen Nightmare on Elm Street, the first one, probably, you know, four times in the theater. So I, you know, I was at that point in my life and career where I wasn't jaded at all. So you know, I was going to work, you know, working with Lawrence Fishburne and Robert Englund. So I was a fellow actor, but I was also still very much a fan, you know. So I would get sort of starstruck every day on the set. But now, you know, 25 years later, I see Robert, you know, once or twice a year at these horror conventions. And the guy has the most sparkling wit imaginable. Really intelligent, probably one of the greatest conversationalist I've ever sat down with. And now, all these years later, we really connect. And, you know, whenever we meet up in these cities around the states, you know, there's always some sort of big group dinner that occurs. And I think Robert and I have this sort of love-hate relationship, because I love the art of conversation, the lost art of conversation. And you know, when that guy's at a table, he usually holds sway over, you know, he's usually holding court over the entire, you know, situation. And I'm just always sort of chipping in my two cents and sort of challenging him and sort of, you know, trying to keep pace with him. And you know, on one hand, I think he, you know, doesn't enjoy sharing the spotlight.
Okay.
But on the other hand, I think he really likes the sort of, you know, sort of the competition for that spotlight, you know. It's pretty, I love hanging out.
Pull out his sword and duel.
Yeah, absolutely.
He reminds me of like a Broadway actor or some classically trained theater actor that's done every show, every part in every show.
Absolutely.
The King and the Sun. And he seems like he'd have a lot of great stories.
And I think that he really, because of sort of the lowbrow appeal of the Freddy character, I think he sort of worked double time at letting people know that he is a real actor and a real wit. And
That's what I really appreciated, was I felt that he would have been bitter or taken it too seriously when we were doing our 130-foot snake movie for Ken Olant's company, and it had Will Wheaton, Billy Zabka, and fun. He had just the table reading, we sat down and we're like, oh my God, and he came to the table reading. We were very impressed. Uh-huh. He was a doctor that was like in the third act mostly, like the specialist that had kind of a, you didn't know whether we wanted to fuck the snake or like, you know, help us kill it or whatever. He was like in love with his own creation. Yeah. He's like, it's beautiful. Like that scientist that stares too long into the sun. Uh-huh. So he chewed it up and had such a ball. And I respected that he was like, I'll go low right now. Let's go. Let's do it. Let's have fun.
Right.
And let's shoot this thing in 16 days or whatever it was. Now you on, when you get to something and years, and like I'd mentioned, like The Mentalist or Monk, or, you know, you kept working in TV and film. Mm-hmm. And even a great remake in 2010, you did I Spit on Your Grave.
Yes.
Were you the Robert Englund at that point? Were you the one with the stories on the set? Were you the one with the experience? Go, when you do the blood gag, you got to turn that way. And I mean, how did that, we were like, dude.
I worked with, that was one of the greatest experiences I've had making a movie. And
Tracy Walter.
Amazing.
I bow down to Tracy.
And you know, the state of the industry right now, 5 years ago, a movie like that, you know, probably $1.5 million budget would have had trouble getting quality actors. But there's so little work going around right now that really great actors are willing to work for really no money. And so I was surrounded by a real quality ensemble of actors and the director and the DP.
Is the Walmartization, they are doing a price war and saying, we've dropped production values down with no budget, low budget, no union, non-union, some union.
Right.
Scale?
Right.
Fuck it. Deferred, maybe $100 a day if you're lucky.
Right.
Oh, you're working more than a few days in the week? 75 a day, you fucker.
Right.
Okay. And that's on the ones that will pay you cash, you know, within 2 weeks of your first day of shooting.
Right.
You know, that's what's interesting, though, is big brands, are they going to allow the little low producers to fill those shelves while the price war is coming down to nothing? No. Kellogg's and Tide and Coca-Cola are going to undersell themselves to keep their brand on the fucking shelf. So when the price wars come back up again, people remember their brands. That's why big stars and people that do get, used to get 10 grand a week will go 600 a day. I'm totally down.
Right. But I think that, you know, there's two sides of every coin. I mean, that, you know, on one hand, you know, the budgets have gone so far down and you know, the further down they go, producers realize that people are willing to work for no money. So, you know, they're running with it. And, you know, on one hand, it's...
And work harder.
Yeah. And
you're in character all day. You're always rolling.
No stand-in.
There's no fucking rehearsals. There's no, right. No retake. It's run and gun, shooting 15 pages a day.
Right.
And you can actually do it because you're not moving around as many lights.
And right. And also now with, you know, the real revolution is digital. You're
always in character.
And well, now...
I swear. And I don't know whether you like it or not.
Well, I think I had a revelation. I did a movie called Rule of Three. Mm-hmm. 2009, I think I did it. And it's the first movie I did where I, great script. I auditioned, I got the offer and they were going to pay me $150 a day. The whole entire movie shot in 9 days. They made it for $60,000. I was working 3 days on it. And when I first got the offer, I thought, you got to be kidding me. $150 a day. Don't you know who I am? And, but I thought about it and I thought, well, God, it's shooting on the weekends. It's a great script. I'm not doing anything else. So I took the job and it was one of, if not the greatest acting experience I ever had. There was, 13, 15 page scenes. The entire movie took place in one room and the director wanted to shoot it like a play. So, and again, with digital, you don't have the additional cost of 35mm or even 16mm film, which is incredibly expensive. So they can run a camera all day long and, you know, worry about it in editing. But I did this film and it just completely opened my mind to working on projects like that. With production costs coming down so much, really great stories are now being shot that probably wouldn't have had a chance 5, 6, 7 years ago. You know, this movie I did, Rule of Three, being a perfect example. I just had a blast. And also, if I'm working for $150 a day, I feel like I have the right to speak up. And I feel like I'm more a part of the process. You know,
chunk of your nuts in this.
You're, yeah, like, if you're paying me,
you're not just paying me off to shut up and stand on my mark.
Right. If I'm doing a TV show and I'm getting $8,000 for a week of work, it's kind of like shut up, hit your mark, get in your light and say your lines.
It also rolls over you. They're incredibly prepared. This is the 16th episode out of the 24 they're shooting. They've been back to back. They're about to go on a short 3-week hiatus. They're like, shoot this fucker. God, right. It's about to rain. Oh, great.
Right.
And it is rolling thunder. And on this, you're like, you do get, especially if things start to boil down at the end of the day and the page count to go is getting a little long and we're, all right, but we're getting into it now. We're into the meat of this. You can't even help it. You wind up helping direct the damn thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Get and it in the can.
That's the thing about, I spit on your grave. I wasn't like the old pro on the set. I guess I was, but that's the amazing thing. All these years down the line, and especially like you just said, on these small films, my experience on so many productions really comes to the fore, and I'm really able to contribute and, sort of help, I feel like on a lot of these smaller films, I've been on far more sets than the director, I'm able to chip in my 2 cents. And if you're only paying me $100, $150 a day, I don't really have any filter. I don't feel bad about sort of crossing those lines, Pretty great.
I feel you're not going to go tell Schwarzenegger where to stop when he's walking away from camera to turn around and say, I'll be back. He'll know when to fucking do his shit.
Right.
Right.
And also, that's something, in the downtime, I started going to film school and I've directed a couple little shorts this past year and I just love it. I know it's such a cliche for an actor to say, well, I want to be a director.
You get the t-shirt when you get your SAG card. They give you that. But what I really want to do is direct.
Right.
It comes with the card.
But what I really want to do, want to do is direct.
Yeah, I know.
And I'm pretty damn good at it.
Are you in your pieces or do you step back and
direct? I'm in my pieces because I'm too much of a control freak. Both shorts I shot, no crew.
Do you edit yourself?
I, from beginning to end.
Total control freak.
Wrote it, directed it, shot it, no crew.
Put your own music in? With your band? Or
no,
anything?
No, no. No, I steal music from people.
Nice.
And my two, the two shorts are, you can see them on YouTube. My YouTube page is Rotney67, R-O-T-N-E-Y-6-7. And I just love it. Doing a project from beginning to end, creating it, shooting it, editing it, sound design, all of it is such a gratifying experience. And, these shorts that I did, obviously I didn't get paid any money. I had to pay to make them. And doing those projects gave me more satisfaction than any acting project I've ever done. So I'm kind of gearing up to make another one in these next couple of months.
Do you have any feature rhythm of stories? Do you have any of those larger stories? How long are the pieces that you're tackling?
The two that I've done were just really, 6 and 7 minutes, which is a great challenge, And that's why I like, school. I just went to LACC, Los Angeles City College. They have a great little program over there. A lot of the professors actually teach at UCLA as well. And I didn't go because I felt like I had to learn how to make a film, but it's really great having, getting assignments and having a deadline and being given
You're
sort of...
using them.
Because I'm a lazy artist.
Deadline.
So if
they
I have...
give you some tools and some shit to use.
That's right.
Stuff?
If I have somebody who's pushing me and I've got to get a project in...
You filmed Boot Camp. You did it and you did City College, so it was cheap as hell.
Right. $30 a class for a semester. That's pretty great. And they have a great program.
And UCLA, for those that have heard of USC Film School... And for those that have heard of UCLA Film School, really UCLA's the writing program is pretty amazing at UCLA for story, for screenwriters. UCLA is the place to go for being deeply entrenched in the business and connected and having
the most amazing technical expertise, USC Film School, I think.
Have you ever
technical directors
dabbled? Have you ever gone to school?
No. And I, you know, I was thinking about this on the way over too, because I was going to ask you about that. I was going to ask you about film school. Is no. And I did. You know, I was going to ask you. Did you feel that you had learned? Like you said, you knew where to put the camera and stuff.
Right.
What did you think? Okay, so you were going to get motivated. You were going to be told, here's an idea, you know, here's a beginning and an end. Go shoot this, and here's a deadline.
Right. Well,
what else? What did you learn?
What I did learn was the technical aspects. You know, I went to class and I sat in the front row and I took incredibly detailed notes, and I still have that notebook, and it really is like a film school. You know, it's really everything that you need to know about the technical aspect of making a movie is in those 50 pages of notes. And that was really beneficial for me, because I don't want to end, you know, this is just a beginning. I really do want to direct real projects at some point. And I want to be able to say, I want to know what I'm talking about technically when I'm running a set. So I'm not,
you have the means to the end.
Right. I don't want to be like, what kind of lens? I want to know exactly.
The actors often get just enough knowledge to be really dangerous on a set.
Right.
and especially kid actor. I was a real kid, like kid.
Right.
Oh God, how fucking obnoxious I was on a set. People tell me now, occasionally I have a guest on and I've worked with as a kid. They were like, boy, you were a brat.
Oh,
like, really? I thought I was a good kid. Fuck.
Right.
I was this little, you know, 8-year-old jaded, 8 going on 40.
You tell Ralph Waite that I said, I don't know.
Did you have Arrested Development? Did you have party time in the 80s after Elm Street? Was it just work? Because, I mean, you worked, I mean, forever and ever and ever in a day. 80 titles at least on IMDb, which is incredibly impressive.
Yeah, a resume actually used to mean something in the business. It's pretty sad nowadays. A resume just really doesn't mean that much, you know. I'm not bitter.
No, they said that it's not a career index or a star index. It's a heat index now. And
right.
It's about who's hot, and that there's absolutely no longevity. And the studios love it because there's no payment. They don't have to build up to $20, $10 million a picture.
Right, there's no quotes
anymore. Channing Tatum's
anymore.
The closest one that they're like accepting into the A-list studio system right now. And Emma Stone's getting close too, but no one's at that kind of old star system, $20 million. The studios are like, mm-mm. And the stars are plunking down the money, pulling a Get the Green Go, self-distributing, like
right.
Mel Gibson's good. We've talked
back
about
end,
that on the show.
You know.
Yeah, making their own stuff. Ted Danson, I was admired for producing his own movies of the week and stuff outside of Cheers.
Well, I think that's really, you know, that's a big reason why I'm interested in directing also, because it's really come down to that. No one is going to hand you anything in this business. And I really feel like the way to go is definitely to write your own ticket, you know. And I have some great feature ideas, and you know, I'm going back to school next week and working my way into the screenwriting class. That's the next sort of technical.
And they're going to give you an assignment, aren't they?
I'm so excited about it.
You're like, right. Great, I'm all set.
It's like working in a little mini studio.
This
you know,
is
it's pretty
such
great.
A great idea.
What do you like to write? Is it horror, comedy? Do you have a preference?
I'm pretty dramatic, you know. I sort of lean towards darker subject matter, not horror, but sort of the darker side of life. And you asked if in the 80s, if there was, you know, party time.
Yeah.
Yeah, 80s, 90s, you know, the double O's, aughts, whatever we call it now.
What day is it?
I'm, you know.
Did you become a personal question and on the air? I don't want to ambush you or anything.
Right.
Are you born again, recovered, 12-step, anything like that? Or are you just, you made it through?
I made it through, and let's just say I'm taking care of myself. And, you know, I've come out the other end. And I wouldn't change any of that. You know, it's given me an incredible wealth of experience and put me in a position to where, you know, I'm getting older now. And I mean, a lot of kids that are coming up that, you know, I see so much of myself in them. And it's kind of great to be able to be in a position to maybe be able to help some kids coming up and, you know,
good
to not make the same mistakes that
you so totally deserve it. Because back in the day, with the kind of groups and circles that were in town and all the kids that were working, everybody had their kind of like, oh, project. Oh, that's the one that did the Twilight Zone movie. That's the one that did this. I had babysitter, this right. and that. And you certainly, you walked in the door with Elm Street and you fucking owned it. And I think that you didn't piss all over it like some people have.
Right.
And you certainly kept at it. I mean, they brought you back for four. If Bob Shea didn't fucking like you, you won't go and be in four.
Right.
You kept humble, you kept at it, keep telling the stories. But you didn't have to do the 10 years of work before and the summer camps and the interlocking and the, you know.
Right.
And the theater training. I was on Broadway at 7.
So you
jumped right into the pool and you did just cry. Just fine.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it.
What an amazing very, very legacy kind of just to be in the Elm Street movies alone. I mean, it's pretty great. That's a huge thing.
Yeah, but so. Then to get, here's just shared credits. I'm just going to mention shows that we did, not at the same time, but right. Starman was a great show to be on.
Right.
Right? I didn't get the Who's the Boss thing, but you fucker. Damn it. No, Jake and the Fat Man. Against the Law. I actually did an Against the Law, which
I've
is so fucking hysterical. And you did the pilot. I did not do the pilot. Aha. Now I see what's happening. I can't believe you were in Hull High. And that just...
Two episodes.
Blows me. I know.
Yeah, I actually...
That was a musical, right?
Yeah,
wasn't it the original
Kenny
fucking Glee?
Kenny Ortega's first foray into the musical. Kenny Ortega, who created High School Musical. And Hull High was a High School Musical 10 years before High School Musical came out. And totally ahead of its time. But the public was not ready for it. But I did two episodes. And somewhere online, if you Google Rodney Eastman Hull High, I have a full singing and dancing number. It's pretty great. Pretty amazing.
I know we just have a minute left. What do we want to promote coming up? Coming up this in Orlando, right? Mm. You're going to...
Yeah, Orlando, Orlando, Florida, October 26th to the 28th, Spooky Empire, a great horror convention. You can find more information at spookyempire.com. I have no stake in it, but ElmStreetLegacy.com, Never Sleep Again, great horror documentary. That's about it. I've been
thank
doing
you, you know, so much I, for coming in. And I want to see those shorts and keep telling stories and get those out there.
YouTube, Rotney67, R-O-T-N-E-Y-67. And I've got a fan page on Facebook, the Rodney Eastman page. Check it out. And also,
a radio voice just popped out.
I've got some music.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Casey.
This is great.
Coogan, yeah. John Donahue from BeyondTheMarquee.com.
A lot of fun.
This was the call sheet. Rodney, appreciate it.
Great time. Thank you, Keith.
All right. Thanks, man. Take care. Have a good night.
Good night.
Out. Listen to Chickster's Nest every Saturday at 11 a.m. Pacific Time. Tune in to SkidRowStudios.com and hear the crazy Chickster in action. I'm insane in the membrane. I'm insane in the